Good morning, everybody. This is Turfgrass Epistemology. I'm Travis Shaddix. It is a beautiful day in Lexington, Kentucky. It's April 29th, 2024. Members only show. Good morning. I'm so happy you could be here. Somehow I feel like a little more intimately connected on this particular show because I know it's just my members listening live anyway, and then it's posted a couple days later. I hope you had a good weekend. I had a good weekend. If you're watching this, it's Turfgrass Epistemology. It's how we know what we know. I've been getting a lot of questions and comments in the various videos and requests on, you know, what do you recommend for my lawn? And how do you know this? Or how do you measure that? And da-da-da-da. And those are all valid questions and fine questions. But this channel is Turfgrass Epistemology. It's about how we know things. And I happen to use turfgrass as my topic to pursue that interest, epistemology. So, you know, if you're looking for, you know, how much nitrogen should I apply to my lawn? Or how do I sharpen my lawnmower blades? Or those sorts of topics. This channel's probably not the channel for you. I mean, you'll just by happenstance happen to come across some stuff that I go over that helps you with that stuff. But this is more epistemology, how to, you know, critical thinking, building skills to protect yourself and to enhance your critical thinking skills and, you know, all these things. So while, you know, as a scientist, I'm very happy to pursue those topics in terms of your lawn care and like how you measure certain things in soil science and all those things. As a scientist, I'm happy to do that. But I provide that service through calendly.com/Travis Shaddix. You're more than welcome to log on and pick a time and schedule it, and I'll go over all that stuff with you if you want to. On this channel, I'm more interested in epistemology. I'm more interested because I think there's so many channels out there that some of them actually provide pretty sound information, pretty sound advice and recommendations. I mean, they're not all bad. Some of them are good. But I don't know of any that do what this channel does in terms of like providing a path to what is more likely to be true. In other words, thinking about how do you know that? You know, how do we go find information to determine whether or not it's true? How do we prioritize the information that we receive, right? So that's kind of what this channel is about. So, for example, you might learn something on this channel that I use turfgrass to help explain and to go over, but you might use it in another part of your life, like, I don't know, buying a house or hiring someone to do something or your political interests or religious interests or whatever, right? Because the critical thinking skills are applicable across any topic, really. So just kind of a heads up. That's kind of what the channel is framed around. And then if you want to know, you know, what's the rate of, you know, prodiamine you apply and when do you apply it? There's all extension bulletins for that stuff. And there's all sorts of resources that you can rely upon to get that information that you may happen to get on this channel too, but it's not the original intent. So, good morning to everybody, Looney and Randy. Mark F has my favorite profile picture. he has a profile picture of a not only one of my favorite actors, not necessarily humans, to be frank, but actors in one of my favorite movies as his profile picture. And I wonder how many people know that immediately. Oh, man, yeah, Life Aquatic, he says, Mark F. says, one of my favorite actors is Bill Murray, especially in Life Aquatic. I don't know how many people have seen Life Aquatic. But that takes a special an interest in comedy and Bill to appreciate that movie. And I do appreciate that movie. And Chuck, how did the Zoom meeting go? Yeah. I mean, there was, I don't know, the people that were there, five or six or seven members came to the Zoom meeting a week or two ago. I can't remember when it was. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do with that. My thoughts were on the Zoom meeting. I help, for those of you who don't know, for the pro members, I do a Zoom meeting. I'm thinking I'll probably do it every couple of months. And the intent is just to foster an environment of discussion and conversation about what's going on in your particular area and what's working and not working, and kind of build relationships. I think several people on there had never met. I never met anybody on there face-to-face. Well, except one or two have been on Calendly. So that was the intent of that. And I mean, I guess it went well. We'll see how it goes. I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants on some of this stuff. So if it develops into something, great. And if it doesn't, man, we give it a shot and see what happens. So I appreciate you asking, Chuck. And Cody M says, loving the videos. It's really changing my approach on lawn care and saved me a bunch of money. Well, that's the intent, to have you develop critical thinking skills if you don't already have them. If you already have them, then just enhance them. And then just ask yourself, well, how do you know? How do I know this information I'm getting from YouTube is valid, or I'm getting from some marketing flyer? How do I know that's accurate? I'm not saying it's not accurate. I'm just wondering, how do you know? And then when you start pursuing that, you start to, well, for me, when I started pursuing those questions years and years ago, I started without realizing it, or without identifying the names of certain flaws in reasoning or skills, I started developing and harnessing this skill of simply asking, how do you know, and pursuing these questions. And if you don't know, you don't, doesn't mean you're wrong. It just means that I don't have much confidence in that, because I don't know how you know. I don't know if there's any evidence to support that position, but it doesn't mean the position is wrong. So until I have evidence to support the position, I don't have much confidence in that position. That's basically how it works. And so, yeah, I appreciate your comment, Cody. That's kind of the hope, is that, you know, you start to save money or provide or produce a better product for the same money. Either one of those works. Okay, today we have a video. I thought I came across the largest lawn care YouTube channel months and months ago, whenever it was. And I've shown a couple of videos of another channel, because he has like 500,000 subscribers. But I came across one, I think it was yesterday evening, and I was like, holy Moses, this guy dwarfs the other channel. I didn't know there's a channel that had 843,000 subscribers. Holy Christ. I mean, with lawn care stuff, in this particular video, he goes over humic acid. So we're going to go over that, and we're going to discuss that and use some of the papers that we've already gone over this month on biostimulants to basically help educate you all and help educate myself, and, you know, again, harness and develop these critical thinking skills a little further. So without further ado, let's get into the video, and then we have an article that we'll go over as well today. So see if I can get this on the screen. So the video today is from a channel called Silver Symbol that has 843,000 subscribers. That's insane. Holy cow. The name of this video, the title of this video is What Humic Acid Can Do for Your Lawn. And this particular video right here has 120,000 views. I mean, that's crazy. Got to figure out whatever he's doing, because, man, that's nuts. So let's listen to it a little bit. And this video is only 5 minutes long, but I'm only going to listen to the first hour or minute and a half or 2 minutes, because after that, he ends up going into like the product and explaining things about the product that are unrelated to your turf. It's more like the physical properties of the product or whatever. Okay, so let's get into it and see what, I don't know the guy's name. I'll call him Silver Symbol. Let's see what Silver Symbol has to say about what humic acid can do for your lawn.
If you want to have a great looking lawn, you've got to have good soil. And nowadays, most of us just don't.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I hear this a lot, more frequently than I think the average person might think. But most of us just don't have good soil. Most of us don't. I mean, where is this coming from? I mean, I don't doubt that some of us have soils that are challenging to work with. Certainly not. It's not out of the realm of possibility. But I've grown plants and grass and you name it, tomatoes and potatoes and apples and pears and peaches and watermelons and cantaloupes and peas. I mean, I've grown a lot of stuff in a lot of different states. Oklahoma, Florida, Kentucky. And maybe I'm just the one out of a million, but I don't have bad soil. Okay. I've never had bad soil in Oklahoma. I didn't have bad soil in Florida. I don't have bad soil in Kentucky. Now, I did have an area out by the road where the sidewalk was built. The goofballs building the sidewalk, they had leftover concrete, I think, and they just dumped it in the hole and then they just put some sod over it. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get grass to grow there. And I went down to cut some of the grass out. And basically, I don't know why I was even taking the grass out. I'm not sure why I was digging down. Maybe I was taking a soil sample and I just hit concrete. And so as I started removing the sod, it was just huge chunks of just concrete about 3 or 4 inches below the grass. And so I started just removing it. And we'll come to find out it was probably, I'm going to say, a good 5 or 6 square feet underneath the swell between the sidewalk and the road of my lawn that was just concrete underneath the grass. So, I mean, that's just constructing builders or whatever, just, you know, being goofballs and throwing some excess concrete away rather than putting it in my lawn rather than putting it where they should. So that can happen, but the soil is fine. They just dumped concrete and put sod on top of it. So I guess what I'm saying is it can happen, but it's not that common. And he said, and this particular gentleman says, what was his exact words?
Good soil. And nowadays, most of us just don't.
Nowadays, most of us just don't have good soil. So my question is, and I replied back to one of the members on a comment just earlier today. I try my best to reply to the members first on the comments of the videos, but I can't always do that. And his question was something about soil structure and stuff. And my comment to this gentleman and as well as to the member was, it's the same. And that is, how do you know that soil structure is causing a problem? How do you know that you have bad soil? And how do you know that that's resulting in unacceptable turf grass? Right. In other words, think about the problem more than the solution. And if you think about the problem, well, how do I know my soil is actually quote unquote bad to the point that it's resulting in a lawn that's unacceptable to me or a fairway that's unacceptable to me? Football field is unacceptable to me. How do you know? All right. I'm not saying you don't have one, but I'm just saying pursue that question before you start buying a bunch of stuff and throwing it on your lawn and have a good reason why you're convinced that the soil is actually bad and resulting in unacceptable turf grass. Because I don't care. Honestly, I don't care what the soil is. What I care about is what the turf looks like. And if the turf is unacceptable because the soil's bad, then we have a good reason. We can pursue that, right? But we're not growing soil. We're not growing soil microbes. We're not growing soil structure. We're growing grass that is influenced by those factors. But I want to make sure that that factor actually is likely causing what we're seeing in the turf before we start to pursue some curative action, okay? So anyway, consider that before jumping on the wagon and trying to fix a problem that you don't actually have. Let's continue in the video.
And the problem is, improving your soil is a lot of hard work. You can do things like top dressing, put down soil, peat, compost, but it all will wear you out. But in this video, I'm going to show you a way to improve your soil without all the hard work and to get it done so that you can really have a great looking lawn.
I'll just say this. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I am saying that I'm extremely skeptical of anybody that says they can improve your soil without any work, without any hard work. I mean, okay, if you're going to improve your soil, if that's what's causing your problem and you're determined to improve your soil, I don't think you're going to do it without any hard work. In other words, they're not just some magical product you're going to throw out there and suddenly cure your soil problems in most cases. We continue.
Before you buy that next bag of fertilizer, remember that soil is key if your lawn is going to do well. And even if you know that, the problem is improving poor soil is a lot of work. And it just is beyond most of us in terms of budget, or even if you've just got too much space to make it practical. So what?
Well, that's probably true. Yeah, it is very expensive in many cases to improve your soil. That's the reason I'm saying I would rather see people pursue the question, do you actually have soil that's bad enough to result in your unacceptable turf first? Because keep in mind, let's take the definition of bad soil, if you want to, whatever that definition is, let's define it as a soil with no structure for just discussion purposes right now. So let's say you have a soil that has, it's structureless. That is essentially every USGA putting green ever built, every California style putting green ever built, every sand capped football field ever built, most of the state of Florida, okay, especially South Florida, it's almost structureless in many locations. And there's turf grass being grown on all those settings that are perfectly fine, very acceptable. Okay. So it's not always the case that a structureless soil is unacceptable for, or is unlikely to result in acceptable turf grass. That's not the case. It might not be the easiest to grow on. You have to know how to manage it properly, and there's certain inputs that you have to be aware of in order to manage a turf growing on that soil relative to a turf growing on, say, a native soil that does have a structure to it. But the point is that turf grass can grow in cracks of sidewalks, okay, with enough water and no fertilizer, and you'll see Bermuda grass growing in sidewalk cracks, okay? So, it's just not as common as people make it out to be that your soil is so bad and so you can't grow grass on it. Now if I'm talking to YouTube, and, this is a small channel, but this Silver Symbol guy has 100,000 views on his channel. 100,000 people watch that video. If only 0.1% actually have bad soil, which is reasonable to assume 0.1% have a soil that's causing some issues. That's a lot of locations, right? Out of 100,000. So it can happen, but it's nowhere remotely close to as common as people make it out to be. At least it's not in my experience. I've run across, you have a horrible soil. Let's do something to amend it so that your turf is acceptable. It's just not normally encountered in my experience. We continue again.
I wanted was a solution that was easy, cost effective, and really worked and could improve my soil with proven benefits. And that's where I finally got a solution that could work for me. And here is the solution. Humic DG is a concentrated form of humic acid in granular form. That just means it's pellets that I can load right into that spreader right there and spread on my lawn.
So before we go too much further, the Humic DG is a product from the Andersons that we've gone over a couple of papers that included that specific product. Listen to the claims, and then pay attention to what he says in the claims, and then we're going to go to the research and see what it says.
All you need to know about humic acid that matters is by adding it, your lawn will have a better soil structure. And in fact,
where does that come from? I don't understand how people just say these things. I mean, like I said, I put out a short this weekend, and the content of the short was, I think 99% of the people who claim their product's going to improve soil structure don't even know how to measure it. And I got a few comments back on that. but I would add on to that not only do people who claim their product will improve soil structure don't know how to measure it, I bet 99% can't even define what soil structure actually is. They just say it. It's a hot button. I don't know. It gets people's attention. I don't know why they use it, but I bet they can't even define it, much less measure it. And here we go again. Let's, you apply this product, it's actually going to improve your soil structure. One, why do I care if you even improve soil structure? If it, the reason why I would care is if I'm, I've done proper investigation and determined that indeed the soil structure is resulting in unacceptable turf grass, that would be a good reason. But it's going to take a heck of a lot more than just some advertising saying I need to improve it for me to be convinced that that's actually necessary. Let me continue.
Some studies have shown that it would take thousands of pounds of organic compounds, things like compost, to equal what humic acid can do.
Now, see, those are, I haven't introduced this topic. I'm sure you're probably familiar with it in the news and some other debates. But there's a phrase called weasel words. And weasel words are things like, well, they claim that da-da-da-da-da, or they said that, you know, whatever. Those are weasel words when they don't define what it is. And when you say, some studies have shown that you need thousands of pounds or whatever. Some studies, those are weasel words. And it's a way of introducing a topic without actually providing any evidence or any source to that someone can actually go and look up to confirm whether or not what you're saying is true. Some studies show, okay. That's a weasel phrase, if you haven't heard it before. And I haven't introduced that before, but anyway, that's what that is.
So think of it like a concentrated boost of organics, but it's more than that because in addition, humic acid allows your lawn to take in nutrients much better than without it.
So there's one claim. It allows turf grass to take in nutrients better than without using the product. That's one claim.
So all that means is if you put down fertilizer or other supplements, adding this humic acid allows them to be more readily absorbed into the lawn.
So more readily absorbed. So there's a lot of ways to measure that, but essentially what he's saying is that the nutrients that are in the soil, once this product gets applied, they'll be more readily available or more soluble or however you want to define that. And generally, I would prefer a plant uptake number. I would prefer nutrients in the tissue sort of data, but you can also get an idea what that is just from a normal soil sample because you're measuring the soluble and the extractable in say, a Malic 3, and we're going to look at that in a minute.
Now, this is a huge deal, and I don't want to bore you with more details, but that's why you want to use it in a nutshell.
Okay, so that's it on that video. He goes into some other like stuff about the product and shows how it's not dusty and things like that, which is fine. That's, you know, whatever he wants to sell the product. He also talks about a reference in the description of the video, saying you can go into the description of the video and find a reference, which I pulled up, and I'm going to go through that in a minute. But before I do that, I'm going to show the tables that I've already shown in the previous videos about nutrients and the effect of this specific product on soil extractable nutrients, meaning this is a measure of what he's saying in terms of applying the product and having more of the nutrients available or soluble for the plant to be able to have access to and take up. Okay, that's the claim. And not just on, well, that's the claim on HDG from Silver Symbol. But let's go see what exactly the research has to say about that claim. And if we go to a PDF, this is the PDF we've already shown once before. This is a supplemental table from a paper by Lindsay. If I can get my pen out here. And although this journal is highly questionable, to say the least, he has a supplemental table in here that has the effect of various humic-containing products on extractable phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, calcium, sulfur, zinc. And it has pH, cation exchange capacity, organic matter, soil moisture, and soil compaction. And what I want to point out is this isn't measuring just quote-unquote humic acids. This is measuring that specific product that was in that commercial, which is right here, HDG. Holy moly, that's a big pencil mark. Okay, so HDG is specifically measured in this study right here. And you'll look down here, the way to read this is the phosphorus column, anything directly vertical in a column. Well, you're not going to see it in here because there's not many, but you sometimes they'll have letters, or down here they'll have an LSD, which stands for least significant difference. And this 0.05 means at the alpha 0.5% level, which means that when they say something differs, there's a 5% chance or less that they're wrong. Okay. Or in other words, or if they say something's the same, there's a 95% chance that they're correct. That's what that stands for. I got a note the other day, said they didn't understand what LSD means. So that's what that means. And you'll notice NS, which stands for no significance. There's no difference in the extractable amount of phosphorus, whether you used this particular HDG or not, untreated. So you're looking at I'm looking at these two right here. 16.8 parts per million phosphorus when you applied HDG, and 16.7 when you didn't. And there's no difference. And there's no difference, by the way, on any of the other humic-coated urea products above it as well. There's no difference in extractable potassium, 121 from HDG and 125 parts per million when you didn't apply any from non-treated soil. 593 from magnesium and 588 when there was nothing applied. Okay, 2,323 calcium with HDG and 2,289 calcium when there was no HDG. There was a difference in sulfur, but not from HDG and non-treated, actually, because this study contained a gypsum source, and gypsum is calcium sulfate. But no difference. There was no difference at all from any element on a soil test, phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, calcium, sulfur, zinc, when you used HDG compared to when you did not. There was no influence on pH. There was no influence on CEC, which is a measure of the soil's ability to retain cations like magnesium, like calcium, like potassium, those things. There was no change in that, the soil's ability to retain cations when you applied HDG compared to when you did nothing. There was no difference in organic matter. Remember, he said that this is a concentrated form of organic material. And when you apply it to your lawn, you know, it's all these magical things are going to happen. Well, when they measured it here, organic matter from HDG was 4.3%. And organic matter when you didn't apply it was 4.3%. Nothing changed at all. Soil moisture didn't change. And soil compaction did not change. So nothing at all in terms of soil chemical properties, or in the case of compaction or even moisture, soil physical properties. There was no benefit at all from applying HDG compared to not applying HDG on these soils on growing, I think this was Kentucky bluegrass on a native soil in Iowa. But let's go to another one, just in case you're not convinced. Let's go to the other supplemental table from another study conducted by the same authors. This time it was on a putting green on bent grass, and you'll see a similar setup where you'll have the treatments here, very similar treatments. And we have HDG here, and we have non-treated soil here, and we're looking at soil moisture, compaction, pK, magnesium, calcium, sulfur, zinc, pH, CEC, and organic matter, very similar to the previous example on native soil. And we see there's, again, absolutely no difference between non-treated soil, so the turf grass didn't receive any HDG, and there's no difference between that and applying HDG on soil moisture, on soil compaction, phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, calcium, sulfur, zinc, pH, CEC, or organic matter. So, you know, as I mentioned at the preamble to this episode, this is epistemology. How do we know? Well, what this particular gentleman's silver symbol is talking about is just complete BS, meaning he has no clue whether or not what he's saying is true, nor does he care what he's saying is true. He's just trying to convince you that this is true and buy it. He has an affiliate link and is in the description of that video. I care whether or not it's true, what I'm saying. I care whether or not I'm accurate or correct or not, right? So when you hear stuff like that, it's difficult sometimes to determine whether or not this person is correct or not. He's got 800,000 subscribers. You know, I have like 1,000. I'm the little baby compared to him. So it's easy for the average person to go, well, he said this and he has a citation in his description and he sounds convincing, so it must be correct. It's HDG, it's humic dispersal granule. It must help. But when we actually go into the literature and look at it, we find that there is no evidence to support those claims at all. Okay, so how do you know? The answer is he doesn't know. And I'm not saying what he's saying is a lie. And I'm not saying that the HDG wouldn't do it. What I'm saying is there's no evidence to convince me that it would. Okay, that's a difference. There's a very important difference between those two phrases. It's like saying from a jury, it's like saying that the defendant is innocent compared to saying the defendant is not guilty. Okay, we don't ever say the defendant was innocent. The jury finds the defendant not guilty. Okay, so it's the same thing here. I'm not saying that it didn't work. I'm saying that I'm not convinced that it did. And until I see evidence, I'm not going to be convinced. And even when I do see evidence that HDG does something, I'm going to compare it against the body of existing literature and weight it properly. I need to know the source. I need to know the quality of the study that was conducted, the robustness of the study, how many years, what kind, you know, all these things in order for me to fairly balance it out, because I already have evidence in the literature that shows in those settings over multiple years on multiple settings. So it's on a putting green or a native. So I already have evidence that shows that it, you know, I already found that there was no evidence to support the claim that it does anything beneficial in the soil. So that's the thought process that's going on in my mind. Okay. When I see these things, or when I hear them, listen to these things, it's just a bunch of BS that just goes in one ear and out the other. But the average person might not have that. I don't know. Or they might believe it's true. They might absorb it and believe that it's correct without actually going into literature and investigating it. Now, that particular video had a PDF in it, and you can read through here. This is from Soil Biotics, which is obviously, well, I'm assuming that they're involved with selling the product, making profit on the product. And you can read through here, and you can just see the talking points that the Silver Symbol gentleman was reading. And it says, what is biostimulant? What is humic acid? What are the economic benefits and so forth? And you can read through here, humic acids physically modify the structure of the soil with benefits such as. So this whole paragraph right here is complete BS. Improved structure of the soil. What I would want to know is, what is your definition of soil structure? And if they can't answer that, I'm not even moving forward any further. Okay. Because if they can't answer what soil structure is, then clearly they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Okay. And then if they can't answer that, I'm saying, how did you measure it? Because I'm telling you, these are things that we measure in undergraduate soils 101 classes. This is not particularly complicated to measure, but it's not common to measure. And I doubt seriously if they even know what they're talking about when it comes to soil structure at all, much less understand how to measure it. Prevents soil cracking, helps soil loosen and crumble, and thus increases aeration. I mean, if you're going to help a soil loosen and crumble up, that's degrading soil structure. I mean, that's what this says. So they don't even know what they're talking about. We don't want soil to crumble together and disperse, basically. We want it to hold together, not crumble. It's absurd. Increasing water holding capacity, darkens the color. I mean, all these things are just complete nonsense. So you can read through here. It's in the description of his video. Humic acids chemically. So we're talking about physical changes, and then he has these talking points of chemical changes, enhance uptake of nitrogen and promotes conversion of nutrients, NPK, iron, all these things. And it's all just complete nonsense. Okay. Biological changes. There's probably something in the literature there, but we showed on those same papers the microbial carbon and potentially mineralizable nitrogen and all that stuff from that specific product. And you can go back and look at the video, and they didn't show any influence on any of that either. Okay. So, you know, this is where they get this information. And then what happens is, I think because they read it on a PDF, they assume that it's true. And then they just go on a channel that has 800,000 subscribers and just regurgitate this nonsense. And that's how it kind of gets perpetuated. We want to be able to protect ourselves against such nonsense and such piffle, and use the evidence as best we can to make the decisions as accurate as we can, using the best evidence we can. So that's a little bit on those videos. So I wanted to go over that. I saw that yesterday, and I was just flabbergasted. The number of followers, like, Jiminy Christmas, is unreal. So good for him to have so many followers, but it's a shame he's just as guilty as many other channels on perpetuating the BS in our industry. Let's look at the chat real quick before I go to the video, or go to the PDF. Oh, Randy says he cracked the YouTube algorithm. Apparently, he did something right when you want to get YouTube followers. Whatever he did, that's crazy. That's crazy. That's serious, serious. That's big time revenue that you can generate when you have that many followers. And then Cody says he believes he has that many because he makes simple videos covering a lot of home repair, et cetera, not just lawn. Oh, okay. I don't know. I haven't watched his other videos. So maybe it's not just lawn care. That's what you're saying. Okay, that could be true. Yeah. Yeah. No, okay. So Chuck Benzing asked a very good question. And I like the members only thing, kind of, because I know everything, every chat was from a member. And so all I got to do is just read through here, and I'm going to try to do my best to answer any members' questions. On the Thursday night show, which is much larger, there's other people in there, and I can't always keep up with everybody's questions. But Chuck Benzing's question is, soil structure is or is not the same as soil composition, sand, silt, and clay? It is not the same. So sand, silt, and clay is soil texture. Soil structure is the manner in which the soil holds together. So, for example, you would have like a silt clay loam would be a texture description, but a blocky or platy soil would be a structure description of a soil. I'm really going back into like deep, you know, elementary soil stuff. It's good. I haven't done this in a long time. Those of you who don't know, my undergraduate is in horticulture and landscape architecture with a specialization in turf grass management. But then my master's and PhD are in soils. I'm soil and water science. And so I've taken a fair amount of my life has been spent on studying soils. And this is basic soils. You take that sort of soil class usually in undergraduate soils and soils and the environment and things like that. Those sorts of undergraduate classes, you would learn the basics of that. And then when you get up into grad school, sometimes you end up having to measure that as a part of your thesis or dissertation or whatever, which I never did. I didn't have to do it for mine, but that's the difference. So soil structure is the manner in which it holds together, and the soil texture is the composition, sand, silt, and clay composition of the soil. Okay. And I replied back to, I don't remember which one it was, but I replied back to a couple of people today on a comment on a video, because they were asking, well, how do you measure that? The ASA, the American Society of Agronomy, publishes books called Methods of Soil Analysis. Hang on. Okay. The books look like this. Okay, this particular one is Methods of Soil Analysis, Microbiology and Biochemical Properties. Okay, if I can get that in focus. So this is part two. Part three, I think, is chemical. Yeah. So part three is chemical analysis. And I assume, I guess the physical is part one, I guess. I can't remember. I don't have part one. But you can still go on ASA and download the book and all the chapters in the book. And in that book, you'll have every valid method of measuring anything you'd ever want to measure in soils. Okay. So when it comes to measuring soil structure, I posted the chapter link to, I think it's part one, of the Methods of Soil Analysis book by the ASA. And in there, you can, if you're so inclined and you're really interested in learning how to measure soil structure, all the methods are in that book that I posted. And I would post it here, but I don't know if I can pull it up quickly enough to post it in here. Anyway, that's that. Okay. So now what I want to do is I want to go ahead and get into the article. This is a pretty straightforward article. It's what I'm trying to do. And so, okay, before I get into the article, this is the last article on biostimulants for the month of April. And then next month, I'm going to go in, and in May, I'm going to be going into like mental health and mental arguments and psychology stuff, which I'm not an expert. I'm not a psychologist, but I'm going to venture into that world in May. But there's already, there's so many papers on biostimulants that I haven't covered yet. I might end up going back into biostimulants in June, because what I realized is, if I pull up the PowerPoint, what I realized on the scoreboard here is that I've only been able to go over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then today will be 7 papers on biostimulants in turf grass. And almost all of them show nothing happened. But there are some papers that show some positive responses to biostimulants. I just haven't been able to get to them. So I may end up reverting back and doing biostimulants more in June as well, and then trying to focus just on the positive. So if you look on the scoreboard, you'll see the one we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 field studies, and all 5, whether it's from Irvin or Munshaw or Lindsay or Bolton or the Lindsay second paper from Lindsay, none of them showed a positive response to seaweed extract, humic acid, microbial inoculants on Bermuda grass, creeping bent grass, or Kentucky bluegrass. None of them showed a positive response in the field. But the Zhang Irvin paper on creeping bent grass in the greenhouse did show a positive response, not just in the plant, but also qualities that we care about, like turf quality and color and things like that. So I wanted to show, I'm saying all that to say this, I wanted to show some of the positive responses in the literature from biostimulants, but I had a specific criteria in my mind that I'm having difficulty. So that's where you all come in if you're listening to this. I'm looking for a paper or papers that concluded there is a beneficial turf grass response to the application of biostimulants under the following conditions. In the field, published in a reputable turf grass journal, a refereed impact factor journal, over more than 1 year. And it's hard to find. It's not easy to find. So I'm going to show a paper today that shows a beneficial response in the field, but it wasn't over multiple years. It was only on 1 year in 2 locations, which is what's fine too. But if you can find a paper that's in a reputable refereed impact factor turfgrass journal that shows a beneficial response to biostimulants in the field over multiple years, please shoot it to me. Send me an email or put it in a chat or put it in the comments of this video, and I'll put it in the folder and I'll try to go over it in June. Okay. So this is what I'm talking about. We have field today and we have all these field studies and nothing happens. And then in the greenhouse, something does happen. And the other papers and the other Zhang papers that I haven't gone over yet, many of them show positive responses, but it's in the greenhouse usually, and it's usually on some plant constituent, not necessarily the actual plant itself being quality or color or green up or something like that. So I want color or quality or green up or ball roll or something that we care about in the field over multiple years following the application of biostimulants. That's what I'm looking for. So if you can help me out, then send it my way. But I'm having difficulty tracking one down. I'd like more than one, but it's apparently not easy. Okay, now we get into the paper. The paper today is using humus on golf course fairways to alleviate soil salinity problems. This was by Zhu and Lee. And Lee was, let's see, was it Lee? Lee was at North Dakota State, and Zhu apparently was at the, in China, at the Shanghai, or the Shenzhi Agricultural University. So this was published in Hort Technology in 2018. Okay, so we're just going to get into it. It's not that long. I think I can get it in 15, 20 minutes. It's not really not that long of a paper. So based on national survey, golf courses in the United States use 2.3 million acre feet of irrigation water per year during 2004 and 5, with 12% of all golf facilities using recycled water as one of the water sources. This was Clark's paper in 2009 with the GCSAA and NGF. We've since updated that. This was published 4 or 5 years ago. Recycled water usage increased from 14.7% in 2005 with around 25% in 2013. Of all water used on golf courses, most recycled water has elevated salt levels. So we're going to find in this particular study that there's salt issues on both of these fairways. One of them is receiving recycled water with high salt levels, and it is at a point where it would be concerning to me. Salts cause physiological stress on turf grass and have negative effects on soil properties, including structure, water movement, and nutrient availability. I would say that's definitely not true. Salts don't cause that. Excessive salts under the right conditions may result in that for sure. But you can put a ton of salts on some of the grasses in South Florida and not have a lick of problem. But under the right conditions, meaning low irrigation, low rainfall, clay soils, you know, low permeability, these sorts of things, salts can definitely be a stress factor for sure. So that's a little worded a little too strongly, but that's fine. Therefore, increased use of recycled water, along with inherent soil salinity problems on many golf courses, makes salinity an important issue in golf management. That's true. There's a lot of golf courses, not so much in the Southeast, but in the mountain areas, this Arizona and up into Utah, these areas can have, in Colorado, these areas can have soils that are high in salt. But if they don't, they oftentimes are required to use recycled water as a means to basically get rid of wastewater. And in that wastewater, depending upon the type of the level of wastewater treatment there is, they can have very, very high levels of elevated salts. And one wastewater facility right across the street from the other can have completely different nutrient components in the water and salt levels in the water. Okay. We were doing a study on recycled water in South Florida, and my colleague down there was getting her water from, I think it was Hollywood, Florida. And we ended up tapping into the recycled water right across the street, across the fence of our facility. And that water was so clean, it was hard to even use because it was so clean, where her water was quite dirty and I needed that bad water. So anyway, the point is, just because you're using recycled water doesn't mean it's bad. But if it's high in salt and you're continuing to apply it and you're in the right conditions with the right grasses and so forth, it can definitely accumulate and cause issues. There's very little doubt about that. Okay, so that's the setting. Okay, he made the setting pretty clear, is that turf grass is irrigated with salinity, or salt water and so forth, or reclaimed water, and it can be a problem. The objective of this study was to test if applications of humus on golf course fairways by top dressing or spray can alleviate soil salinity problems and improve turf quality. Okay, so they're going to be applying humus in the form of humic acid or in the form of peat, like sand peat that you would normally apply to like a putting green. The study was conducted from 2015 to 2017 on two golf courses. During 2015 and 16, the study was on the 17th fairway of Valley Country Club in Aurora, Colorado. The fairway was covered predominantly with Kentucky bluegrass with negligible amounts of annual bluegrass and perennial rye and was aerated. Okay, so he goes through and explains the setup and the nitrogen applications. They talk about using stabilized nitrogen, which we've learned is not. It's not helping, really. It's not giving you what you think it's giving you. But they're applying, you know, I guess here it is UMAX. They're applying UMAX on their fairways and 1 pound and so forth. They go through the whole process and explain what they're doing. Okay, turf grass was mown at 0.65 inches. The recycled water was from a local treatment plant. Okay, and I'm going to go over the components of that in a second after I get through the materials and methods. I'm going to show you what the water contained. During 2016 and 17, the study was on the first fairway of Bully Pulpit Golf Course in Medora, North Dakota. The fairway was covered predominantly with Kentucky bluegrass again, with some perennial ryegrass. Gypsum containing, gypsum containing 20% calcium was applied at 750 pounds per 1,000 square feet monthly from May to September. I think that's an error because, let's do the math on that real quick. I'm pretty sure that they meant to say 750 pounds per acre, I think. I don't know. But if you do 750 pounds per thousand, okay, so monthly, so you're applying May, June, July, August, and September. So 5 months, you're applying 750 pounds. So 750 times five is 3,750 pounds per thousand. Okay. You multiply that by 43, and you're going to come up with 161,000 pounds. Per acre over those months. So I'm going to divide that by 2,000. It's just easier to deal with. 80 tons per acre for that year. Now let's say you have 20 acres of fairways, which is about it's 15 to 20 acres is the average for an 18-hole course, something like that. So you multiply that by 20 You have 1,612 tons of gypsum going out. And let's say each trailer can hold, let's say 20 tons, or let's say 22 tons. So you're gonna bring in 74 truckloads of gypsum and put it out on your fairway. 74 tractor trailer flatbed loads a year. I don't think that's possible, because 74 tractor loads, and you're doing it over 5 months, you're dealing with 14 tractors a month. You're dealing with one entire tractor load every other day, basically, and you're spreading it out. And I hesitate to do all this math live, because I'm undoubtedly made an error, I'm sure, but someone can check my math. But I think that's why I think it's 750 pounds per acre, not per 1,000 square feet. And like I said, I'm sure I'm making an error, and you know, I'm sure some of the naysayers out there will be happy to put a comment in the video and say I was wrong, and that's fine. But I just don't think that that's correct. I think it's 750 pounds per acre. Anyway, and that could just be a error in the editing of the journal. But regardless, the point is they're putting out gypsum, and I can't believe it's at that rate, but they're still putting out gypsum even at 750 pounds per acre, which is almost never needed. But it might be needed in this case, because the level of salts the sodium in this particular setting is high enough that it might warrant the application of gypsum. You wouldn't apply gypsum for salt. You'd apply gypsum for sodium, but it might warrant it in this particular case. Let's go. The two study sites follow the same research protocol. Treatments included top dressing with sand, sand plus reed sedge peat at 90-10, or sand plus reed sedge peat at 80-20 by volume, or sprayable humic substances from this Rev Dakota peat, which is a humic from peat, not from leonardite shale. It's from the peat. And they apply that either at 1 gallon or at 3 gallons per acre, and then a non-treated control. Okay, I'm gonna go over the treatments in a second, and make it a little bit more clear on a table for those watching. The reed sedge peat contained greater than 90% organic matter. The sprayable humic substance was a suspension with particle sizes less than 100 micrometers, and containing 21.2% humic acid and 0.8% fulvic acid based on dry weight. Each treatment plot measured 20 by 50 feet. Now, I highlighted that in yellow because I wanted to kind of remind myself to make a point for the superintendents who work with turf grass scientists. If you work with turf grass scientists and you're a golf course superintendent, thank you. Okay. Keep doing it, because whenever we do it on research sites, our sites are not that large. And so we have to use small plots. And with small plots comes a greater sensitivity to error. Errors can occur, and it's more difficult to account for those errors on tiny, tiny plots than if you're dealing with a 20 foot by 50 foot plot. And you can do that just across an entire fairway, right? So whenever we can do work on golf courses, it's a little bit of a catch-22, because we're relinquishing some of the responsibility and some of the control to the superintendent. And sometimes they're required to just do stuff. Like, for example, I'm just pulling this out of thin air here, just completely aerify right over part of the study. And I'm in no way talking about a study that I did, and kind of mess up the study, but they got to do what they got to do. They're not, you know, they're not going to lose their job because you're not going to aerate something because you have a study on it. They're going to do what they got to do. So you're relinquishing some control, but on the flip side, the benefit to us is that we have a much larger plot to pull data from. And I feel that the accuracy is greater, or the practicality is greater when we can do it on golf courses. Treatments were applied in the first week of May, July, and September each year. Top dressing was applied at 1/8 of an inch of depth, and humus was sprayed at a spray volume of 30 gallons per acre. Soil properties and turf quality were evaluated on the 15th or the 16th of each month from May to September. And they go through all the examples and all the explanation of what they did and how they did it. Turf visual quality was evaluated on the 1-9 scale, where 9 was best, 6 was minimally acceptable, and 1 was completely dead turf. This is technically not accurate. One is not dead turf. One is dead or brown turf. In other words, dormant turf can be brown but not dead, and it would still go as a 1. The turf grass was scanned at 1 meter above the ground with a handheld data collection and mapping unit using the Green Seeker, which is very common. Okay, so that's how they did it. So we're in North Dakota and Colorado, and we're on two locations that have salt stress being from the application of irrigation water, effluent water. Now, let me see if I can get all this on the screen here. I'm going to show you. I'm not going to be able to do it. Let me see if I can. Well, okay, I can get most of it on here. So the soil and then the water is over here on the left. So I'm looking at the electrical conductivity and pH and all these things, bicarbonates and phosphorus and potassium, sodium, all these things. And the EC on these, which is the electrical conductivity and decisiemens per meter in the Colorado soil, is about one, and the water is also about one. So that's not alarming. It's not so high that I would point to that immediately as a potential problem, but it can be a problem if you don't get enough water to kind of move those salts downward if it accumulates over a long enough time, okay? And the sodium in the soil was 140, is this parts, yeah, parts per million. And they don't tell me the extractant they used, but 148 parts per million sodium, which is, you know, again, not crazy, but elevated. I mean, it's definitely on the radar. And then on, in North Dakota, the soil, I'm sorry, in Colorado, the water was one, and the water was 7.8. And again, you can see the water components here. And you're adding sodium, probably from the salt. You're adding, let's see here, very, very high sulfur contents at 154 parts per million sulfur. So, you know, you're adding water that's from an effluent water treatment facility, and it's not that clean. But when you go to North Dakota, the EC in the soil was 3.3. Now, as a rough number, the and this is going to depend completely on a number of factors, but primarily the genetics of the plant, meaning the species or the cultivar of the plant that you're growing. When you're dealing with an electrical conductivity in the soil of 3.3, there is a pretty good chance that that is probably resulting in leaf firing or wilting or unacceptable turf grass, because the number that I'm comfortable with on with EC with just say an average, not like a salt tolerant plant, but like a plant that's more sensitive would be around two decisiemens per meter on EC. Around two, you're probably on the cliff. Three and four, you're definitely over the cliff. So when I tell superintendents or turf managers what kind of EC is are you dealing with, and they come back with something two or greater, it's definitely a note to make, a point to make a note of. Okay. I'm not saying that is causing your problem, because you may have like seashore pest palum or something. You may have Bermuda grass that's 20 years old and very, very healthy and very, you know, robust. And they might be a little bit more resistant to some of the salt problems. But, you know, it's definitely something to be aware of when you get greater than two. And he's at 3.3, and the water is at 2.4. So he's constantly applying water that is high in salt. Okay. The pH is 7.6 and the water pH is 8.3. So he's definitely dealing with this particular superintendent in Medora, North Dakota, is definitely dealing with effluent water that is concerning in terms of its influence on turf grass performance and quality. Okay. So we go down here and we see the sodium level at that particular location, the soil was 660. So we're dealing with, I don't know the def, I can't remember. It's not going to show me like the sodium absorption ratio, and I guess we could determine it. Where's the CEC? I don't see the CEC on this. Yeah, you don't, he doesn't have it. I mean, you probably could determine the sodium absorption ratio on here somewhere, somehow, but I don't know if this is both a saline sodic soil or just a saline soil, but you definitely have some, a couple things working against you. Not only do you have high salts, but you have a sodium content. And again, I'm not a sodium expert. I can't remember the exact level at which sodium would be a problem. There's a lot of things going on there, but it would be a concern. In other words, I wouldn't want to apply gypsum if all I had was a salt problem, because you're just going to make the problem worse, because gypsum is a salt. But if you have high sodium and high salts, then you're going to have to figure out some way to get rid of the sodium. And generally speaking, that is application, hopefully, of clean water or a lot of rainfall, but also the application of calcium sulfate can help move that sodium through the soil. And then afterwards, we can deal with the salt issue. But gypsum does not cure salt problems unless you also have a sodic situation, okay? And in this case, in North Dakota, I would want someone who's a sodic soil specialist to come in and probably give me their opinion on that, but I think you might have both in that setting in North Dakota. Okay. Okay, so that's the setup. They have turf grass in Colorado and turf grass in North Dakota on a fairway, and they have salt and they have sodium, and they're applying sand with peat as a top dressing, or they're applying just humic acid instead of applying the top dressing. And they're going to measure quality and NDVI and all these other variables and see if any of these provide any benefit to the turf under salt stress conditions. Okay, so let's look. So here we are at table two, turf quality as affected by top dressing and humic applications on golf course fairways in rural Colorado. So this is the Colorado site. So the humic acid at 3 acres, you'll notice in May, there was about a half a point increase in quality following the 3 gallons per acre, the humic acid at 3 gallons per acre. It was the same as the sand with peat applications. And then you move on into June and July and August and September as you move into the summer, and you'll see this humic acid at 3 gallons actually provide an increase in quality, certainly compared to the control doing nothing, and also compared to the sand top dressing where you're not applying any humic substance at all. But it's always at least at the top. Nothing's greater than humic acid at 3 gallons per acre, but there's occasions where the sand peat at 80-20 and the sand peat at 90-10 result in an equivalent quality as the humic acid applied at 3 gallons, okay, on the quality scale. You'll also see more or less the same response from the NDVI, which is a measure of the natural green reflectance of light of the plant using an instrument. You'll see that the 3 gallons per acre resulted in the greatest NDVI. And there was a couple differences, but generally it was always greater than the control in pure sand. But occasionally the sand peat applications resulted in a similar quality as the humic acid applied at 3 gallons per acre. Okay, but humic acid at 3 gallons definitely resulted in a beneficial response in quality, whereas the humic acid at 1 gallon didn't always separate out from the sand peat treatments. When you go to North Dakota, give or take, it's basically the same thing, give or take, where the humic acid at 3 gallons resulted in as good or better quality than any other treatment and differed from the control and differed from sand, but didn't always differ from sand peat. Okay. And in the NDVI is the same thing, where the 3 gallon humic acid always was as good or better than anything else and was better than the control or the sand, but wasn't always better than the sand peat treatments, meaning that the application of humic substance, either in the form of peat or in the form of humic acid, was resulting in a beneficial response in quality or NDVI. Primarily, the benefit of humic acid came from the 3 gallons per acre and rarely came from the 1 gallon per acre, okay? So this is, again, I'm trying to find a beneficial response in the field from humic acid. It's not easy. These weren't repeated in time. They were just repeated in locations, which is fine. It can be fine. I'd prefer to see what happens over time at the same location. But here is a paper showing there can be a benefit. Now, this was humic acid from peat that might differ greatly from humic acid from leonardite, or might differ greatly from a humic dry granule that then is claimed or assumed to then be converted into humic acid after it hits the soil. So I wouldn't say humic acid, Shattuck's has shown humic acid resulted in a benefit at 3 gallons per acre. What I'm saying is this specific humic acid from peat under salt stress conditions on Kentucky bluegrass did show a benefit. Okay. When you compare it to sand peat, it was hit or miss. So in those situations where you see a response, you see a benefit, and I would say the sand peat is probably sort of like a standard control, like this is something people would probably do, then I would start comparing the costs. How much does it cost to apply a sand peat versus applying humic acid at 3 gallons per acre. And in this particular case, I don't know the price of these, but I would assume, perhaps incorrectly, that humic acid applied at 3 gallons per acre is probably less expensive than applying sand peat at whatever it was, an eighth of an inch across the fairways, I would think. But I mean, I could be wrong. So, you know, there's a little bit of supporting evidence here in this paper for the use of this specific type of humic acid on under salt stress conditions in North Dakota and in Colorado. Let's go to this particular table here before I go to the conclusions, and we're basically done. So the soil properties. Now, I can think of probably 1,000 soil scientists that are far more knowledgeable than I am on soils, okay? I mean, yeah, I'm a low man on the totem pole when it comes to soils, okay? There's many, many men and women who are vastly more knowledgeable on these issues than I am. I'm just saying that to say this, is that it's my understanding that the application of these products in some rare conditions might provide some sort of benefit to the turf, but it's not normally from altering something in the soil per se, like a physical or chemical component of it. As Dr. Irving said, I don't want to speak for him. You know, if I'm misspeaking, he can correct me. It seems to be a hormonal effect. Either applying cytokinins or applying some other hormone to the plant at a time when the hormones in that plant are low. So we're supplementing a hormone to the plant when the hormone is low and then imparting some benefit to the plant at that time. It doesn't seem to be, at least not consistent in the literature, that the application of humic acids or biostimulants is causing some sort of physical or chemical change in the soil. Okay, so I'm saying that to say this. I could be wrong. There's a lot of soil scientists who are smarter than me. But when you hear all these claims that, oh, humic acid is going to change the soil structure and humic acid is going to, you know, increase all the nutrient availability, it just doesn't seem to be supported by the evidence that I'm looking at in the literature. And here's some soil properties in North Dakota and in Colorado from this same study. And we see the control in the sand peat at 90-10, the sand peat at 80-20, and the humic acid at 1 gallon and at 3 gallons. And you see the pH, for the most part, doesn't change a whole lot. There's a little bit of reduction at the highest rate of humic acid, but 7.7 to 7.64 is, you know, not a whole lot going on there in May. Kind of the same thing in July, kind of the same thing in September. There might be a little bit of an indication. There might be a little bit of a drop in pH as the months go by from the humic acid at 3 gallons and from the sand peat at 80-20, where you're going from 7.73 down to 7.59. So it's a little bit of dropping. I mean, this is only 1 year. And so while I see a movement downward, I'm not completely convinced that you would see a continued movement downward, but it is beneficial to see a movement downward rather than static or moving upwards in terms of pH in this particular soil where you're dealing with high salts and high sodium. The electrical conductivity, which is meaning the salt level, we're not seeing a whole lot from the humic acids at all. It's the same as not doing anything in May, the same as not doing anything in July. And then we see a little bit of a decline from the 3 gallon in September, but no difference between the humic acid in September at the 1 gallon compared to the control at all. We see the reduction in electrical conductivity coming from the sand and the sand peat treatments. These here, these treatments that are bees here all are from sand. So when you're going to see reducing electrical conductivity, you'd want to use a sand that's already low in salts and use that if your intention is to lower the salts. Because it doesn't seem to me, at least in this study, that you're seeing a reduction from electrical conductivity, at least in the Colorado soil. The infiltration rate, again, did not seem to be influenced at all by the humic acids. They were the same as non-treated soil. But the increase in infiltration rate came from the treatments that included sand in September. Okay, so the sand treatments seemed to be lowering the electrical conductivity and increasing the infiltration rate, whereas the humic acid treatments did not. The bulk density, there wasn't any change in bulk density with humic acids in September. There might have been a little bit of a drop. Again, biologically, not much. Practically speaking, not much in May. Nothing in September, but there was a little bit from the sand treatments on both May and September from the one sand peat treatment. So organic matter, again, not a whole lot going on with organic matter. It's basically the same as the non-treated. When you see this MBC, the microbial carbon, basically, you do see an increase from the two top dressing treatments that contain peat and then the humic acid, well, actually both humic acids, compared to non-treated turf and compared to the sand top dressing turf. Now, in the previous studies we've looked at, these treatments didn't have any effect on microbial carbon or potentially mineralizable nitrogen, anything like that at all. Here's a study where we do see a little bit of a bump in increase. It goes from 1,300 milligrams per kilogram in the non-treated control to about 1,400 in the 3 gallons of humic acid. So there's a little bit there in this particular study showing there might be something going on with that humic acid or humic-containing treatments. Now, when we go to North Dakota, the pH seems, there seems to be more of an influence in North Dakota than there was in Colorado. Remember, North Dakota was the one that had the very high salt levels, very high sodium levels. And you see the humic acid treatments and the sand peat, let's see, the sand peat 80-20 all result in a reduction in pH compared to non-treated turf, 7.6 to 7.3, something like that, in September. Electrical conductivity, you see a reduction. Actually, you see a reduction. No, you don't see a reduction. Now, you don't see a reduction in electroconductivity with humic acids at all in May, July, or September compared to non-treated turf at all. So humic acids aren't seem to have an effect on electroconductivity at all. And there may be, again, a reduction in electroconductivity occasionally. Well, actually, there's a reduction and there's an increase from the sand treatment. So there can be an increase or a decrease. That sand may have already had salts in it. I don't know. I have to look further into the paper. The infiltration rates were the same whether you used humic acids or whether you did nothing. So there's not affecting the infiltration rate at all when you use humic acids. But we are affecting the infiltration rates when we apply sand. We actually increase the infiltration rates when we apply the sand treatments. The bulk densities didn't change from the humic acid in May. There was a little bit of a reduction in bulk density following the 3 gallon humic acid treatment in September. And the reduction in bulk density primarily came from the sand treatments again in May and September. Organic matter seemed to increase a little bit at the 3 gallon rate of humic acid in September. But let's see, So the increase from both the sand peat and from the humic acid. So one location that didn't influence organic matter at all in Colorado, and the other location it did in North Dakota did, the 3 gallons per acre of humic acid did increase the organic matter. And then the microbial carbon increased from 969 at non-treated to 1100 using the 3 gallons of humic acid rate and the 1 gallon. So it influenced both of those. And then both of the sand treatments that contain peat, both of them also increased the microbial carbon as well. So the microbial biomass carbon. So there was a little bit more of a beneficial impact in North Dakota than in Colorado. And that's the reason why there's something there probably. I want to see some more repetition because it may have been just the location effect. It may have been the differences in sand, differences in whatever. But if you see something like that happen in North Dakota where there's already high salts and high sodium, there may be something there. I'd like to see another year. There's enough there for me to look into it. I don't know if I'd be fully convinced that, you know, applying these humic products would be beneficial consistently, but there's certainly enough evidence there for me. If I was counseling with a superintendent in North Dakota and he had a similar situation where he's high in salts and high in sodium and his turf grass doesn't look good, there's enough there for me to go, okay, I'm not completely convinced, but this may be something you want to consider. Let's pick a fairway or pick a couple of fairways that are bad and see if we can, you know, benefit it or result in an increased quality from these applications of humic acid, assuming that that's the less expensive of the sand peat humic acid options, because both of them seem like they were having a benefit. And then I just want to know what it would cost per acre to do both. And the reason I'm still hesitant is that this journal is not as high a journal. It's not repeated in time, whereas the Lindsay papers were repeated in time and is a higher quality journal. So I'm having to balance evidence, contrary evidence, and the evidence refuting the use of humic substances, humic dry granules or humic coated urea, the evidence refuting it is substantially greater in terms of magnitude and quality than the evidence supporting it. Okay, so, but it doesn't mean the evidence supporting it is not valid. That's kind of my thought process on this. Our results show, this is the conclusions and we're done. Our results showed that the application of humus increased the soil microbial biomass carbon and improved turf quality over the untreated soils on two fairways that had either an inherent soil salinity problem or was irrigated with recycled water with high salt content. And that's the key. And remember Dr. Irvin's conversation with me, he was doing it in a drought situation. Whereas when he started the drought dry down, there wasn't any difference. But as the soil dried down, those treatments started to separate out. And the same thing might be occurring here, where if you didn't have a salt problem, the use of these products might not show a benefit. But in the case where you do have a salt problem, there may be, you know, some supporting evidence to include those products in your program. Despite the small value, the visual quality improvement over the untreated control at the Colorado site was from unacceptable to acceptable value of 6 for most of the summer. Soil microbial activity is critical to soil nutrient availability and is negatively affected by soil salinity. Therefore, maintaining sufficient soil organic matter is necessary to support the soil microbial activity and soil health over time. I don't know how that's a conclusion, but because we didn't really show much difference in organic matter at one location, but they did at the other. So there may be something there. There may not be something there. But that's the conclusion. The short and skinny of it is, it seemed like the application of the humic-containing treatments, one of those being a humic acid from peat, under salt stress conditions and potentially even sodium stress conditions, might actually result in a beneficial turf grass quality increase. It might increase the turf grass quality in that particular setting. And that came from sand peat and from the humic acid treatment at 3 gallons per acre as well. So whichever one of those least expensive would probably be the one that I'd lean towards. Okay, guys and gals. Oh, Randy asked probably an hour ago. I just now saw this question. What is the definition of good soil water balance, water air balance? Yeah. Well, I don't know the definition of a good soil. Soil scientists can get together and come up with a definition, but generally you think of a soil with 50% solids, you know, 50% air, and half the airspace is filled with water and half the airspace is filled with air. And there's some organic material in there, 4 or 5% organic matter. There's all sorts of ways to define it. But to me, if your turf grass is perfectly acceptable and you're growing grass and looks fine, then your soil's fine. Okay. You know, once we determine that the soil has not been fine or it struggles to, you know, you're having to put a lot of resources in it to keep it acceptable. It's acceptable, but you're having to really pump a lot of things into it. And you've looked at the water and the light and the temperature and looked at all these things on the risk triangle. Then we can start exploring the soil component, or we can start exploring at the beginning. But I mean, then it might actually be a potential cause of what you're seeing in the soil. But I'm not overly worried about the soil unless we have a problem, really, unless we have unacceptable turf grass. And if you have acceptable turf grass, then your soil is probably fine. I'm going to leave you with some music that probably no one's ever heard. I imagine if you've heard this, you would impress the hell out of me. So I'll be back on Thursday night. In the meantime, I hope you all have a good week. Send me any questions on an email or comment in the video if you have any further interest in pursuing this topic. This will be the last biosimulant video for this month. On Thursday night, I'll pop into the psychology world and kind of go down that road for the remainder of May. Okay, guys, thanks a bunch. See you on Thursday night.